Welcome to the Half Percent Podcast. My name is Nick Plosser. Each episode is an in-depth interview with a member of our military, whether active duty, reserve, or vet. If you or anybody you know would like to be a guest, please reach out and contact me, Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, the Half Percent Podcast. This show is available anywhere you listen to podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, Ricochet Podcast Network, Google Play, Stitcher, YouTube, all of the above. Please subscribe, write us that five-star review, and make us part of your feed. And finally, I want to thank everybody for listening. Really appreciate your time. And with that, let's get into the show.
Okay, Mr. Push-ups, let's hear your story.
It's not just the uniform. It's the stories that you tell. So much fun and imagination.
From now on, you will speak only when spoken to. And the first and last words out of your filthy sewers will be, sir. Do you maggots understand that?
Welcome to the Half Percent Podcast. I'm joined by Chief Aaron Siebert. Aaron, thanks for joining the show, man.
Hey, it is awesome to be on it. I really appreciate, Nick, that you hit me up and you wanted me to be on the show. And, I got my own podcast, and it's cool to collaborate in different ways. So, yeah.
For sure. You got your hands in about 1,000 pies, man. Talking before the show, you put me to shame, man, with all the things you're doing. So I'm looking forward to getting into it, man. So before we get going though, let's go back, just get a quick bio, kind of where you're from, and you know, you're growing up, and then what caused you to want to get into the Navy?
Yeah, well, thanks. I'm Aaron Siebert, retired Navy chief, combat wounded in 2006, took over 100 pieces of shrapnel, had my last rights read to me, and I am lucky to be alive. I'm on life number two. But going back to my childhood, growing up as a young kid, and, I grew up in the country mm-hmm. of Wyoming. I was born in Riverton, Wyoming, mm-hmm. where I really didn't remember anything till you're about, 4 or 5 years old. But, we lived out in the country and we had a couple of goats. We grew our own food at times. And, my dad and mom got a divorce at an early age before I remember. And then, but my stepdad was a big portion of my life, and he was a firefighter, drove a truck for a meat place. And, just grew up, kind of living out in the country and just doing some country stuff that was really kind of cool. I think it gave me a, hunting, fishing, just gave me a really good grounding to, the love of this country. And mm-hmm. I think, when I look back at my earliest times in my life, those kind of things were really kind of influential in kind of how I proceeded through the military when I finally wanted to do that. But, I grew up out there in Wyoming. Then we moved into town at some point, did a lot of really cool things. And Wyoming's got a lot of really awesome, vast history, especially with the Indian community and mm-hmm. all kinds of really cool things of that nature. So
a lot of things,
we learn in school at that time was, a lot more about the culture of the Indians and their history and a lot of the country history there. So, eventually I moved to Colorado and, ended up living with my real dad for a while. And then, in, late middle school, time frame, I got a girlfriend that was pretty cool, and her father was a Navy fighter pilot, Vietnam era F-4 Phantom, and mm-hmm. the Vigilante, which is I don't know the designator of the Vigilante, but it was a bird that was really designed to take pictures and really kind of do some reconnaissance type stuff. But he was kind of like my early influence as far as like why I wanted to join the Navy. And okay. then Top Gun came out, and I was thinking I wanted to be a fighter pilot.
Yeah, you and me and my brother and everybody else, man. I came out of that theater, man. I was like, I'm joining the Navy. I'm going down to Miramar, man.
Yeah. And, right about that time, Navy SEALs came out, and I really decided that was something I was really wanting to pursue.
Right.
I got all motivated. I played high school football. I was all conference, all league, all conference, all state. And I was a nose guard. I mean, I loved it. I fought really hard to play it. And when I joined the Navy, I had that girlfriend up until I was about 16. Let's just go back to that point. And then after that, it just, you know, youth gets the best of you and you just grow out of things and you grow into new things and just trying to figure out who you are in the world. And so then I joined the Navy and went through boot camp and stuff and got a girlfriend, and it kind of changed my point of direction.
As they do.
And so I didn't necessarily pursue the Navy SEAL part, but because I joined to be a Navy corpsman, it allowed me to go with the Marine Corps. And I started out at FSSG, which is Group, Field Medical Service Group, but they changed it to MLG, Marine Logistics Group, is now what it's called. But yeah, I started out going through that process once I graduated boot camp and then went through Corps school. Went to my next duty station was Naval Hospital Long Beach, which was shut down. It was a cool adventure.
Yeah, right down the road, man. real quick before we get, what did you join straight out of high school, and then what? And then did you ever you knew you wanted to be in the Navy?
I did, and you know what? I think one of the mistakes I made. I joined out of high school. I joined in Colorado, but my mother and my mom had moved in with my aunt down in Bellflower, which mm-hmm. was really close to Hospital Long Beach.
Right.
So I went down and spent the whole summer hanging out for the summer until July 17th of 91 is when I went in, graduated high school, you know, in 91 and hung out for a couple months during the summer, just getting some more time on the beach and hanging out mm-hmm. down there, mm-hmm. Long Beach and stuff like that. But Huntington Beach and all that good stuff. But, then I didn't join until the end of high school. What I should have done is you can join 365 days before. And, that gives you some benefits that, you know, I didn't take advantage of because I was just like, oh, I'm just going to do it the way that I'm going to do it. You know, and sometimes you don't really have all the information. It didn't mess anything up, but overall it would have been a better choice to.
Yeah. Looking back a little bit, just to do a little thing slightly differently.
Yeah, if you know your future and you want to get involved in it, it's one of those things where you look back, you're like, hey, jump on it right away, find out about as much as you can, sign up for whatever you got to sign up for, and then, you know, if you're long projected situations a year out, then project it a year out. Mm-hmm. But if you sign up at the last minute, you might be missing out on some things. So yeah,
right,
it's one of those things. But yeah, I joined and then went to boot camp right down in San Diego.
I was gonna say your boot camp was in San Diego. Was that with Marines or is that all Navy?
Oh, it's all Navy.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, Navy. But Marine Corps boot camp was right across the fence. And they
I was
going to
say, it's right there, right?
It was, you know, and then they changed it. Now I think the only boot camp they got is Great Lakes. But they did, at the time I signed up, Great Lakes, Florida, and San Diego.
Okay.
That was back in 91. But they would say, hey, if you hop that fence, that's fine. You're just going to be, you know, in the Marine Corps there. you got to make it all the way across that Marine Corps base and hop another fence. So it's like one of those crazy things. But I remember watching the biggest thing that I remember is all the planes flying into San Diego right over my head.
And that's right.
You would be like feeling like, I don't know. It was like you're in jail, you know, because your day is like really regimented. And, mm-hmm. I remember in high school, I was like, man, I can't wait to finish high school. I'm done with this freaking schoolwork classes, had a hard time with tests, doing a bunch of stuff. I said, man, I just can't wait to join the Navy and not have to worry about this stuff. Well, come to find out, boot camp is a lot more educational stuff than it is physical.
Yeah.
You know, physical is a good portion, probably 25%. But the rest of it, 75% is educational. You're learning about ships. You're learning about this. You're learning mathematics. You're learning, you know, the basics on everything that you need to know in the Navy. So needless to say, school was never, it is never over. There's always time to learn. And sometimes you got to learn at your own pace, but not in boot camp. You don't have your own pace. You got their pace and you got to be on it. So
that's right.
So, you know, just getting that piece. But I remember looking at those planes and going, man, there's people coming and going on those things and they're doing their lives. They're living their freedoms. They're doing this, this, and that. And right now your freedom has no way, shape or form a place in society because your whole dedication is to what is about to become your life mission or your 4-year mission or whatever it is that you accept it as. Mm-hmm. That's the standard that you got to set for yourself.
That's right.
I mean, the standards, they're out there, they're this, this, and that, but what you do with it is always going to be what matters.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so then I realized, you know, I did this and that. And then, you know, once you graduate, you know, boot camp, then you got some time off, and went and hung out with my aunt, my mom for a couple of weeks. And then boom, right back into San Diego, going to school for, to be a corpsman.
And, how'd your mom and family feel about you joining Navy?
They were good with it. You know, everybody was really acceptant of my choices. You know, I've always been a strong-willed person to kind of shape my future, shape my desires in life. And, you know, I kind of had direction. I've always had a goal of direction. You know, because it seemed like when I was a kid, I kind of had some instability of things, you know, and, mm-hmm. and you're going through life and, you know, my parents got separated and divorced, yep. and, you know, you just got all this different broken families and stuff. Yep. And I got three brothers and two sisters.
Yep.
And, half brothers, you know, sisters, and, full brother, on me and my brother, Brian, and he joined the Navy too, mm-hmm. for 4 years, and then he got out. But, you know, you feel like you have this instability, and I was like, hey, I want stability in my life.
You're going to impose some order in your life for sure.
I need some good order. I need yep. some good direction. I need, yep. you know, maybe I'm going to just do 4 years and get out and do something else. But, you know, when that 4 year time came, I continued on. At that point, I said, hey, I'm going to continue this as long as I can. And at 20 years, I'm going to have a retirement that I can look back at, or the military is dangerous and I might not make it, but
right.
I accepted everything that came my way. And, mm-hmm. I understood the consequences. I understood the rewards. I understood, you know, I just wrapped my mind around a lot of that stuff and ran with it.
Did you find, cause like I said, you know, when you're enlisted, it's obviously you're dealing with a lot of younger guys, 18, 19, 20, whatever, some older guys, but mostly younger. And did some of those guys, did you find a lot of those guys also had that clarity of purpose and kind of understanding, or was that a bit rare, or were you able to help guys out with that?
There was a lot of guys that, you know, when you deal with the military, it was really awesome. And in boot camp, you really saw it, because all of a sudden you're in with a bunch of guys that came from all over the country, all over the different places, different cultures, different attitudes, different things, different freedoms, different ideas of freedoms. And you come together, and you have to be a team to complete an awesome mission. And it took a long time for me to put all this in perspective, you know, because you're trying to figure it out. Hey, how do we get along together? How do we do this and that? And I think when I was a second class, I think I really kind of understood that you have different personalities.
Right.
And the coolest thing that I think out of everything that I've learned in life is that life is not fair. You hear that all the time.
Yep.
You don't understand it. You're like, how does that equate to me? And what it does for each one of us is personal responsibility is such a thing that we don't talk about anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We just kind of blame everything on something. We blame Amen something on this or that. And there's different things, and I get it. But when it all comes down to is your personal responsibility, how you as an individual are going to take it, and what do you own? What yeah. do you own? And I think mm-hmm. when I was a second class, I really realized and I got it that I'm not managing equality. I'm managing personalities based off of personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, I felt like I finally could understand it's not equal. It's not about being equal. It's mm-hmm. about your personality responds to this differently than this, and this. But I also understood too, as a leader, you know, things that I didn't like as leadership in leadership, all these different things that I saw was, you know, things that were held personal. And I told myself, no matter what, if I don't like you and if I don't get along with you, but you're a hell of a good sailor, or you're a hell of a good Marine, or you're good at what you do in your job, there's no reason why you can't get the EP from me if
that's right.
as a chief. And I saw this and I said, hey, you know what? That's what makes a good leader. But if you have if you play favoritisms, if you do all this and that, it ruins the vision of what you're trying to accomplish by being a service like we are. So true,
man. I've been coaching basketball for 10 years, man, and that is so true in the sports world as it is in the military world. That the good leaders I've seen exhibit a certain set of qualities that you described, where they, you know, larger purpose, they don't take things personally, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, that really tracks with what I've seen as well.
Yeah. And it was a hard, thing, you know, to finally wrap my mind around some of that. But, you know, I can be friends with somebody, and if they just don't perform, I can't in my head, give them the EP and stuff. So,
right.
It was just one of those things that, that you just learn.
So from boot camp, you went to your, you went to just medical school kind of, right?
Basically, yeah, core
everything
school.
You need, core school. Okay. And then
what's cool about that now is core school was, you know, Navy only. And, okay. Obviously we've combined all these medical schools together. So down in Texas, we have combined all medical schools, whether you're Army, Air Force, or, you know, any of them, mm-hmm. they all go to that school. And then, right. They have breakout sessions that are service
only. Specific kind of thing.
Yeah, service specific. But mostly, you know, you're learning the, you know, how to record keeping, all the different things. So you're not all on so many different sheets of music.
That seems from an outsider's perspective, that seems to make a lot of sense. Just so all the branches, because when you go fight a war or you go out, you're mixing and matching a lot of services, and you're going to interact with a lot of different the other branches. So that would seem to make sense from the outside.
Oh yeah, way more than ever before. And I think I think the war in Iraq really kind of opened up a lot of doors to combine a lot of these service oriented issues, mm-hmm. and really kind of iron out some of the details that are required. So,
okay.
Oh, yeah.
But your core school was it in Long Beach, or did you go to Texas?
It was in San Diego.
It was in San Diego. Okay.
Yeah. And it was, you know, school, like I said, is tough for me. I got set back a couple classes, which was for my benefit at the end, mm-hmm. because the first class only, had like two billets. It was like, Okinawa, Japan, and Yokosuka or something, mm-hmm. So you only got those orders to choose from. So getting set back, the orders that finally came out for us, I think, was Bremerton, Washington, Florida, and Long Beach.
Okay.
And, you know, everyone got to pick their class according to how they scored in everything. So in order. And so, luckily, there was some Long Beach, Naval Hospital Long Beach was open. So I grabbed that billet and I went there. So
right where you spent your summer after high school, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right there, and my aunt lived in Bellflower, so I just rented a place from her, and I rented my room, and it was great. So from there, Long Beach shut down mm-hmm. when I was up for orders. Anyway, it was shutting down. The hospital was closed down. They've tore the hospital down. They built the full on Edwards Cinemas and all kinds of crazy.
Oh, is that where it is? Okay.
PetSmart.
I didn't. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of a cool little place now too. But, and then from there, I went to Field Medical Service School in Camp Pendleton.
Okay.
On Del Mar, which is to get you to be a field medical corpsman with the Marine Corps. So once you do that, then you're basically designed to be an 8404. So until then, my designation was a quad zero. Quad zero is just a basic corpsman, work in a hospital. That's it. An 8404 is a corpsman that is now part of the Marine Corps. Okay. And to earn that, you've earned the right by Marines to call you Doc.
Okay.
Not doctor, but Doc. Because we go through some extensive stuff to just be trauma gods. And I mean that because they call us trauma gods because we have to do what we can to save someone's life.
Right.
And sometimes that involves more treatment than is allowed by law in a civilian setting. Even for medical personnel that are highly trained, they can't do some of the things that we as corpsmen can do on the battlefield.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. Like chest tubes, trachs, cut downs, cut downs, basically getting down to the vein and starting an IV because you see it visually because you're cutting through the skin to do this.
Yeah, right.
And just different things of that aspect. And I was in the core, to be a hospital corpsman is the history of the hospital corpsman is huge. Most decorated, all enlisted corps, the only enlisted corps in our military. Mm-hmm. And, got the most decorations, but just incredible things. So that history lives inside of me with the motivation to do the best I can with what I've got. Mm-hmm. And I think I really ran with that. You know, a lot of people are, you know, did you drink the Kool-Aid? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. And you have to.
Right.
If you're really going to be involved, if you're going to do a 20-year stint, if you're going to give it your all, if you're going to go up before a board and they ask you, why should you be sailor of the quarter or sailor of the year or whatever it is, you know, I was only nominated once, and I went up for that, and it was pretty funny. And I was asked that question, and they said, why should you be sailor of the quarter? And I said, because I am the Navy. And I remember back to that, and I was like, that's really an arrogant statement. And it was really kind of a cool impact statement for myself, even for me to say it, for me to hear it, for me to understand it. And I say that because, you know, a lot of times they say, hey, you know, once you get out of the service, you know, you take the rank off, you take this off, you no longer are in, and blah, 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 blah. And I said, bullshit. I'm calling bullshit on
that. Yeah, right.
And the reason why I'm calling bullshit on that is because, for, you know, like I said, when I was 5 years old, I kind of recognized where I was, who I was. You know, at five, you kind of get to develop who you are as a human. And then you're like, oh, I'm on a farm and I'm milking goats. Okay, cool. That's my life as a 5 year old. And but I'm feeding them and I'm doing cool stuff and I'm hunting and I'm fishing and I'm doing really awesome things. And then for 15 years, you go to school, you're a student, you're this, your mom and dad's kid, and you develop that personality. But for 15 years, so for 20 of my years, I was in the Navy. And you're going to tell me I'm no longer in the Navy because you take that rank off me? Right. And it's not true, because for me, I still help out combat vets. I still am heavily involved in my own injuries from getting hit with the mortar round. We'll get into that too.
Yep.
And I'm still very devoted to doing what I'm doing, because for one, the taxpaying money is paying for me for the rest of my life. And because I was hit with that mortar round, it pays a little extra. So it just seems to me, it's kind of my duty to give back and maybe help somebody else along the way.
Yeah, and, for sure. For sure. Know, and that's an interesting thing you met. I've never heard it put that way, but you know, you're a kid, that's your identity. School is your identity, but your identity is kind of defined by somebody else, you know, whether it's your parents or your parents' name or your whatever. And as a football player, basketball, whatever we choose. And then, but the Navy was something you chose, and you kind of had it was all you at the end of the day. The Navy shaped you, but it was, you maximized it, and you defined it within that Navy, it seems. So yeah, it's a much more personal thing at the end of the day, and you're an adult doing it. So.
Yeah. And it just seemed really bizarre to me to, you know, I still wear my Navy Chief Anchor on my hat, and mm-hmm. I still, my Purple Heart. And there's a lot to the reasons why that still is. And, yeah.
And so, once you got done with your school, like where did you go from there? Did you do you have ship duty after that? Did you, pathway after that?
Yeah. I've never had ship duty.
Other 20 years in the Navy, no boats, huh?
No. I've been on boats. Don't get me wrong. But every time I've gone on the boats, it's because I've gone on there with the Marines.
Oh, I see. And gotcha.
So once I got done with field medical service school, I went to 3rd FSSG, which is Okinawa, Japan. Mm-hmm. For a year. And back then it was a year. Now it's 2 years unaccompanied. Meaning if you had a wife, you could bring her with you. But if you didn't have a wife, you didn't. Well, I didn't have a wife. So I went out there for a year. And I loved it. I was on Camp Schwab. The beach is the most beautiful beach in Okinawa. It's one of the furthest most bases north. And right next to Camp Hansen. So, you know, these are really, you know, we do a lot of training out there on Camp Hansen, Camp Schwab, you know, just doing a lot of different things, but lived in the ammo company barracks, and the barracks was like one of the best barracks in the Marine Corps. I mean, the barracks had its own chow hall, its own gym, you know, it's all in one building. It was kind of crazy. It was up on this hill, real grassy, nice hill. And, yeah, it was just gorgeous. And
yeah, I was about to ask. That seems like a beautiful – it seems like a really cool area, an interesting area as well. You know, even the local food, how it's kind of mixed with American and Japanese and local Okinawan culture and everything. It just seems like an interesting place anyway.
Yeah, it's just totally, totally crazy and cool like that. And the culture, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for you to enjoy some culture. The problem with it is that it's so beautiful. You wish you had a wife with you that would be able to enjoy it with you. And, mm-hmm. and that's some of those things in my mind I was wishing at the time. I was like, golly. And from there, I went on a float with the USS Blue Ridge, which is the 7th Fleet command ship. But it came to port because it needed to take a bunch of Marines and was going to go do a demo 5 days in Hong Kong and 5 days in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to go on the ship and cruise down there. And, you know, this is like the first ship opportunity that I really kind of had an opportunity to do. It was quite a cool float. I mean, it was a 20-day float. I think they pulled my name out of a hat, actually, you know, when they were going through, they're like, hey, we're going to have, you know, three or four guys from Schwab go, three or four guys from Hansen. You're just going to go support this mission and stuff, but you're going to have plenty of liberty. And we really did have liberty. And to finally see Hong Kong, and this is back before Hong Kong got turned back over. Before the changeover. So this is my first trip to Hong Kong. And I've made three trips to Hong Kong because I floated with the Marine Corps.
It's an awesome place. I've lived there a couple times over 25 years, man. It's a really cool place. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So
spent some nights in Wan Chai and Lan Kwai Fung, I'm sure.
No, I didn't, you know, we stayed on the ship for the most part, you know, and you know, that E3 pay just really wouldn't cut it.
Wouldn't cut it. Gotcha.
You know, it's so it was just a really cool float. And then, you know, 5 days in the Philippines and just getting to see that and some of the parades and just different cultures and things like that was definitely interesting.
And the Philippines at the time, was it Subic Bay was our base there? Was that right? Am I remembering that? I know it's closed down now, but anyway.
Yeah, it was Manila.
Manila, that's right. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and we pulled into Manila, and even though the base was closed down, and it was closed down when I went there.
Okay. Oh, okay.
At the time. But it had just closed down, so the embassy was still right across the street.
Mm-hmm.
So we went over and, you know, had food at the embassy or whatnot, and it was kind of cool. So it was definitely interesting.
So then after Okinawa, what was your next, what's your next move?
Well, Okinawa, I came back, 3rd FSSG, and coming back to Camp Pendleton, and started doing some field ops and, you know, getting out to, you know, with FSSG, I was with group, and I was with Med Battalion at the time. So Med Battalion, we'd basically go set up these giant static, you know, systems so that we could, you know, take care of Marines if we have to, and BAS is out in the field, and, you know, just supporting the group side of things, and Camp Wilson. And during that time, I also went on the 11th MEU. So the 11th MEU at the time now was a 6-month float. And again, going back to Hong Kong, Hawaii, we hit Hawaii twice, you know, going out and then came back. But we also did RIMPAC. So RIMPAC was kind of cool too. That was a year that I got to do RIMPAC. RIMPAC was, you know, obviously going to Hawaii,
yep,
doing all these war games that are conducted through multiple different countries that participate in that kind of operation. So we got to go up to, and it's hard to remember all these things, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No all these doubt, different man. Bases. And it was a training base for the Army that is up in the mountains and in Hawaii. And we got to go do some shooting. We got to go do some training and stuff, and play some sports with other entities, things like that. And this is during our workup to go on deployment anyway. So it was an extra 2 weeks of craziness, you know, 1 week out, 1 week back, floating across, and then seeing Hawaii again. So and I re-enlisted. I didn't re-enlist at that time, but on that float, I re-enlisted on the USS Arizona Memorial.
Oh, wow.
That was a really cool opportunity.
Awesome,
too.
Man. How cool is that?
So there's a lot of really cool history that, you know, that we were able to conduct during this time, not to mention a beach landing on Iwo Jima.
Wow.
And, you know, on the float. you know, that was there to basically accept all these guys that were on Iwo Jima and have them tour the island that from the time that they went there and
they helped take it.
Yeah, when they took it.
Wow,
and you know, I got to hang out with a corpsman that had done it, and to see him break down in tears and you know, talk about some of the things. And you know, you kind of wonder about that island, because you hear about Mount Suribachi and this and that, and
right,
you know, you see it in pictures and stuff, and you think it's this giant mountain, but when you're on the island, it's really not that big.
Yeah,
it's not a giant mountain. It's a hill. It's way different than what I thought. And then, you know, I watched The Sands of Iwo Jima on there too, which was, you know, a John Wayne film.
John Wayne flick, yeah, right.
Yeah. So while I'm on the island, I'm watching this film, because it was just one of those options. And it was crazy. We went into some of the tunnels, we toured some of the places, and you can see steam coming up, you know, because it's a volcanic type island.
Right.
You know, obviously it's a training base for the Japanese now, and they yep. let us come on there. And they also did this really cool demonstration. I remember it was a father and son, and the father was basically fighting with wooden swords to each other. And they did this demonstration, and the reason they demonstrated it was to demonstrate why the war was won by America, was because America, we were very adaptive to situations,
mm-hmm.
even though in Japanese culture, every move that they do, everything that they do is very precise and very historical. And there is no deviation from that, because that's the way it is. That's the way it was. And that's the way it will always be.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he was demonstrating, the old guy fighting his son, was that his son had adapted to the modern era of changing things up. And so when they were sword fighting, the son would be able to snag another move in there however he wanted to, because he adapted to the situation. And I thought that was a really cool dynamic to understand.
Yeah.
That that was a really cool way to show it, and a really cool way to understand the culture and what was going on there. The other thing that I understood that was going on, those guys in those tunnels, I mean, I had a lot of respect for, you know, the Japanese for fighting the way that they did, for doing what they did. You know, when you look back at war, it's a bloody thing, it's a crazy thing, and being in war myself, I understand, you know, these principles. But, you know, they were fighting for honor. They were fighting for different things that their culture was based off of.
Yep.
Not necessarily what they might have believed in, because that's their culture.
Yep.
And they were living in these tunnels. And these tunnels, you know, you go into the ground, normal temperature under the ground is 55 degrees, right around that 55 degrees. You dig 6 feet down, you're going to be at a 55 degree temperature constantly.
Wow.
However, on a volcanic tunnel place, the temperatures range somewhere between in the 80s to 106. Jeez. So these guys were living underground in these tunnels at these temperatures all day long, fighting their way to the end. And
jeez.
Obviously sinking more ships, more, you know, destroying things. The destruction, the whole amount of loss on that island is huge. And,
yeah,
you know, to understand that history and to understand where these guys were in these tunnels, I was like, holy cow, there's no way that, you know, these conditions are just horrible. But they were living them. And they were
my stepfather was in that campaign in the Navy as well. And so, he didn't never talk too much about it, but my other grandfather, both my grandfathers actually. So, but when I went back and I've read a bunch of books on the Pacific theater of that war and Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and I just, the amount of bloodshed and, you know, casualties we took taking those places. And then you realize, I looked on a map one time, and like you said, man, it's like these islands are not these, you think of them as the main island of Hawaii or something. They're not that. They're these really small atolls basically that you wanted for runways, you know.
Yeah, this island is small too. So, but it was the key point to launch, to get, to supply, to logistically make it happen to the mainland. And It was a have to, and both ways. Then it was just a way cool way to understand Iwo Jima, and to do a beach landing.
We did a
beach landing there. I mean, we rolled the ships up, got out of the on the water, walked up the water onto the land, and boom, we're there. We drove some Humvees off the boat, off the LCU. And they don't even use, I don't think they use the LCU anymore, but the LCU is basically, able to do beach landings. And so we practice a lot of beach landings and stuff. And, in the littoral zones, and you don't hear about that. Littoral zone is anywhere where ocean water hits land.
Okay.
That is a littoral zone.
Okay.
And just terms that, that I'm not familiar with, but I am now.
Yeah, no, that's a really, by the way, a unique experience too, man. That's almost like, you're reliving history, man, but a really significant, such a significant battle in World War in the Pacific Theater, man. So, really, that's really cool, man. That is very cool, that you got a chance to, participate in that and then meet the guys that had some corpsmen before you that were there,
Yeah, that history always plays a big portion of my mind and the culture and the understanding of both sides. And I run with it.
Yeah.
It makes me balanced, I feel.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's interesting you say that, though. My stepdad, even though he and my grandfather, they both always expressed a huge respect for the Japanese. They hated them while they were fighting them, but I remember my stepdad talking about how much respect they had for their fighting spirit and what he described as their fighting spirit and their, that type of thing. So it's kind of jives with what you're saying too as well. So, that's really what a great experience, man. So then after you're done with that, where does that take you then?
Well, the cool thing on this float, I mean, we got to see a lot of really cool places: Penang, Singapore, Hong Kong again. Then we also got to go down to Australia on this float. So I got my shell back. Not only did I get my shell back, we also crossed at the Prime Meridian. So once you do the Prime Meridian and Equator, that turns you into a golden shell back. So, here I am on my, you may float a lifetime and you might not be able to do this, but one float and I'm a golden shell back. So that was just a cool thing for me. When you look back at all these different histories and you go through the ceremony, and man, it was kind of cool on the ship. It's not nearly as crazy as it was back in the day. And now you don't even have to participate in the ceremony. Now it's kind of just, given to you. But I feel like in life, I feel like somebody built the building you're living in. Someone built the house you're living in. Somebody built the infrastructure for water, for electricity, for all these really cool things. And now we're just kind of like little maintenance programs on this thing. So we kind of just show up and here it is. We haven't necessarily had to work as hard as those that have gone before us in history.
No question.
Same goes on ships, and when they had to raise the sails and cruise across, and all the hard work that they probably did, and no air conditioning, no heat, no heating, no, all these different things you look back on, and that history is there. And if you don't have to go through a hard ceremony to experience that, or boot camp, or these things, I don't know if you can fully appreciate what that means. Or even growing up on a farm for me, I mean, I look back and each one of these things are growing steps, and I'm like, hey, man, I'm glad I had to work hard.
Right. Rites of passage, man. They're missing for sure.
Yeah. And I think, the expectations might be a little bit skewed now because of that. But
yeah.
Yeah,
no, I agree. 100% agree, man. That's the military, and I guess maybe martial arts of some kind, boxing, MMA. Those are really the only places that that men, young men specifically, still get those rites of passage. You know what I mean? And hopefully, it sounds like maybe not even the military to the fullest extent if you're not experiencing some of the things that your predecessors did. So. That's interesting. Well, and then so where does that take you? You eventually, we're talking about late 90s, early 2000s at this point.
Yeah, we're let's see here, 11th Mew, getting back, and then I still was part of FSSG for a little while, for basically ever since I got out of Corps school there, or not Corps school, but out of Field Medical Service School, being with the FSSG, 3rd FSSG in Okinawa for a year, and coming back for 2 years with 1st FSSG on Camp Pendleton. So, which is cool because Camp Pendleton has so many different duty stations that you can actually do your whole career on Camp Pendleton overall.
Yeah, it's huge. Obviously, that's a big place.
And that's pretty much what I did, because from there I went to, Naval Hospital Long, Navy Hospital Camp Pendleton, and Camp O'Neill. I mean, right by Lake O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
And I was part of the shoot, man. What was that?
It's escape.
I worked right. in. Yeah, it escapes me. No, I worked in the not preventive medicine, but shoot, man.
No worries.
Trying to come up with what it was called, but preventive health. So
okay,
yeah, preventive health, and just working up on the fifth floor, helping out all those that were working on the base for different things, giving them their shots. Also doing a bunch of shots for some of the active duty guys that were going to like Africa and stuff like that. They'd have to get like specialized shots, which were like rabies and some other things. So, you know, we had a variety of different people coming in there. All the workers that were working for child care development and things of that nature.
Okay.
And this is how I met my wife now.
Okay.
You know, my wife, Robin, she came in to get her shots and I ended up giving her shots, and she had to come back and get her PPD read. And I luckily I had a great chief at the time, Chief Dew, Dickie Dew. Mm-hmm. And he was a recon corpsman, and he was really motivated. And he said, "Hey, let's go out and train PSIs and make sure." And the PSI, just to give you an idea, the PSI is somebody who comes to the hospital because they're waiting to form up and go to field medical service school, okay, which obviously I've already gone to and stuff like that. And they understand, you know, the rigors of that, the training that has to go. It's a lot more hiking and all this other cool stuff that you got to learn, to how to hang out with Marines and do Marine Corps stuff. So these students, they're called PSIs because PSI stands for projected student inputs.
Okay.
And so these were PSIs. They were there at the hospital to fill all these little billets that were really cool. You know, they got to learn something in the hospital, but they're not going to fill medical service school for about a month. They're waiting for, you know, maybe 2 weeks. So we'd start off with like, you know, 12 of these guys. And in the morning we'd run them, we'd guide them, talk to them about some issues and things of that nature. And then they'd go on about their daily thing, but they had to PT with us because we took them on some extensive training and really got them in shape for field medical service school.
Okay.
So we maybe start off with 18, but we had like 200 at times,
oh,
200
wow.
plus at the end, you know, waiting to go to their school. And these guys would fly through with, you know, and this is, I was in the best shape of my life here too.
Yeah, because, I was going to say.
And then on top of that, running PSIs. And so we'd run these guys in the mountains. We'd run them across the river. We'd take them on some extensive stuff. As a matter of fact, we were up one time and I remember running all these PSIs. I got their, you know, they're wearing their Smurf suits, basically a white t-shirt with blue on it. And then, you know, blue shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And this was way back, you know, in the what was this? 1997, 1998. But we're running up there. Artillery is doing some field ops on top of this hill that we took them, you know, across the river, and you go up into the hills. And we're running, and they're like, all of a sudden, I hear this Marine yell out. He's like, "Hoorah, Navy SEALs!" Because he's like, "Where did all these Navy dudes come from, and how did they get here?" Probably right.
Right.
And,
exactly.
So it's just kind of really, you know, there's times you come across some seriously weird motivation that it's just really cool.
That's cool, man. That's cool. Well, so you were out of Pendleton when you got sent to Iraq. Is that right? Or you went to Iraq, you know, 3 times, right?
Yeah, but from here, then I go to now I go to division.
Okay.
Division, 1st Marine Division, and 5th Marines. I go out to 5th Marines. I go out to 3-5, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. And, we're just doing our training exercises, doing everything that we got to do. And, you know, I'm into it pretty deep. Probably, you know, this is like 2001. I get out there.
Okay.
And we go to war in 2003, you know, March 2003, we cross, That's basically when we started. But so I'm out there doing a bunch of stuff with 3-5, and they wanted to move me to regiment. And I said, you know, wait till we get back from this war before you move me to regiment or whatever, because we're going in like 2 weeks. And So yeah, right from there, you know, when 9/11 kicked off, basically, I will say, before that happened, while I'm with Division, we go on another deployment, the 31st MEU. So out of this deployment, again, seeing Hong Kong, doing all these different things and, you know, different places. But the 31st MEU, we train, we all live on Camp Hansen at Schwa in because it floats out of Okinawa, Japan. Mm-hmm. So what's funny is I was on the USS Essex part of my 11th when I was with the 11th MEU. The Essex now moves to Japan and it floats from Japan. So the Essex is now, I'm on the Essex this time. The first time I was on the USS Cleveland. Now I'm on the USS Essex, but the Cleveland, the Essex, and the Harpers Ferry floated on the 11th MEU. Now I'm floating with the Essex, and I can't remember the other ships that were floating with us. But we do the 31st MEU, and you know, this is about the time that Pakistan and some areas are having some difficulties with the testing of a nuclear device.
Yep.
Back in, let's say it's like 2002.
Yep.
And so when we left one of our ports from Singapore, they said, hey, if we take a left, we're going back to Okinawa. If we take a right, we're going to somewhere else because we got to go stage ourselves off the coast of something so that we don't. So if there's an incident, we got to handle it. We got to pull a neo-op, which is basically pulling everybody out of an embassy or something like that. So,
oh, right. Gotcha.
So we're doing all kinds of really crazy tactics. And obviously the world's becoming a little bit crazy, you know, and literally, I get married to my wife on the 5th of September, on right before 9/11,
wow.
1 week before. Wow. So when 9/11 kicked off, obviously that was a big issue, but we're already scheduled to do our MEU, this and that. I mean, we're in the shoot for it, but we go on to alert and, you know, this is before we even take off from America's soil, but we're put on alert. We got all kinds of stuff that are spinning up and things that are getting kind of crazy. So the world was getting kind of weird and crazy, but on the, you know, on the 31st MEU, nothing really kicked off at that time. But the minute we get back, keying up and really getting ready for Iraq. So training, all kinds of training changed and we had to train to get ready to leapfrog and take Iraq and this and that. So it was really kind of crazy. So we've trained all this time for beach landings and all this weird stuff. And now we're training for urban warfare, desert warfare, you know, Camp Pendleton's gearing up and they're putting all kinds of, you know, training bases together to make it look like a town in Iraq or, you know, a Middle Eastern place that, that needs that kind of, security. And we start training in these facilities all over. So, and then in obviously in 2003, we gear up and we all fly to Iraq and we fall in to all the vehicles that were dumped off, all the things that we need, all the supplies. RCT-5 is built. It's a tent city. It's on the edge, ready to cross into the line of departure. And the war kicks off. And I remember my first night. My first night was a rough night. And I'll tell you, it was rough because we had to dig a fighting hole in the dark. We light discipline was crazy. We're on the edge, going, you know, still in Kuwait, getting ready to cross the line of departure.
Right.
And you know, that night was good. I remember that. Okay. It's the second night when my first night in Iraq, that's the night that, was really rough, but all these vehicles lined up. Miles and miles and miles of military vehicles, gas vehicles, all kinds of things going on. And what looks like a lightning storm off in the distance is this antenna hill getting bombarded by Scud. I mean, we even see the Scud missile coming. But we see the Tomahawk missiles that are taking out this antenna hill for the Iraqis. So their communication is devastated. But it looked like a lightning storm from way off in the distance. And you hear this boom, 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 boom. And it was just crazy. And then we shadowed, you know, obviously one area, but we actually crossed in another. And then it was full on. We were just all moving through like a giant convoy, doing some leapfrog things. And those guys on the front lines were just taking things out left and right. And weird things happened to you. you know, before we even crossed the line of departure, I remember in Kuwait, we're out in the desert in the middle of, you know, like a circle of wagons, you know, back in the old Western days, this is how we're set up. And you get this Kuwaiti vehicle that comes driving across the desert, like just some random car
out of nowhere.
And it rolls right through our camp, our whole encampment. I mean, it literally like drives through, and the Marines didn't stop it. They didn't do this. They didn't do that, you know, because it was totally new and foreign to us to even expect something weird like that. I'm just like, hey, did that vehicle just drive through here? I mean, what just happened right there? And so it was really bizarre because we trained for it, but because we don't pull the trigger, or we don't get aggressive, or we don't engage, or we don't do this, sometimes those weaknesses kind of show. And
yeah,
it's like, hey, we're training, but if this happens, it just happens. And it's like, what?
especially given what happened later, you know, with the tactics that
yeah, then they started developing these weird tactics. And I literally, you know, we're herringboning on the road at one point with all of our vehicles, but we're allowing vehicles to come through without checking them.
Mm.
And at one point I actually stopped this tomato truck, a giant tomato truck. It was like a dump truck with a bunch of tomatoes in it, with my 9mm midway through the convoy. And I'm like, hey, these guys get out, they're totally scared. And because, you know, pistols have a whole different meaning than rifles there.
It's right.
Executional.
That's thing. An execution weapon, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So it got really kind of crazy. But then the Marines finally kind of picked up on and made it happen. But I didn't know, you know, that it was going to be me on this whole thing. Because I just felt like, hey, we all need to be safe. We all need to be whatever. But the security in the back is not just letting these cars roll through. Let's do some security checks. And that's exactly what started happening. But it was just bizarre. But nothing was really happening at that time with the IDs, with this and that and stuff like that. So we push all the way up. We push, you know, the morning, and I'll say the most significant point of this whole thing, you know, we'd come out, hollowed vehicles, you know, all these different things. It was very strange, very crazy, very, you know, just every day you're walking through the valley of death, and you realize that, you know, you could go at any minute. And so as scared as you might be, you just realize that you're already the walking dead. So you just got to go. You just got to do what you got to do. And hopefully things work
once
out.
Once you accept that, you kind of, yeah.
Yep. Once you accept that, it's good.
So,
you know, I didn't know if I was ever going to see American soil. But here's the thing. You know, when I left America, it was like, hey, for the longest time, I stood on a wall and I looked out and I said, hey, it's cool. I can see the enemy. Never had to really get engaged with it. And this is just me giving a scenario what combat is like. Then what happens... But you go home at the end of the night. Someone takes the shift. Someone else is watching the wall. And this is happening right now. Someone's watching the wall. Someone's got their eye on it. America doesn't know because they live in this great bubble of freedom. But somebody's watching the wall. Someone's got their eyes on. Someone's standing the wall tonight. And but when war kicks off, now we got to step off the wall. We're not going to go home anymore. And all you have is the thought of freedom. There is no more going to 7-Eleven to get you whatever you wanted out of the fridge. No pizza, no hamburgers tonight. There's no going home to the family and kissing your wife and your kids goodnight. There is no more of that. So your freedom as you know it is only a thought of freedom. And now you're standing in the battlefield hoping you're going to make it, but realizing that you're just the walking dead. You're dead. You're just going through and you're trying to figure out how I'm going to finish this out, how I'm going to stand next to my buddy. This is all I got, the freedom reminder. And I remember I carried two sodas in my backpack, and they said no radios, but I carried a radio anyway so that I could listen to the BBC and kind of get a kind of scope on things. And, you know, it was weird. Like, we had some weird rules, and I was like, man, why are these rules like that? Because I want to be informed. At the same time, I also want to be efficient. But if I didn't have that radio, I'd have been like, it would have sucked. I mean, they even played music. So for us to not have any kind of electrical equipment, it would just been like, dang.
Yeah.
And to cool our water off, we had to hang it on a sock. Like we put our water canteen in a sock and get that canteen wet, and it would evaporate and it would drop the temperature in that water maybe, you know, 10, 15 degrees.
Oh,
but it would be way cooler than the environment. So it tasted like cold water, even if it was 100 degrees.
Yeah, interesting.
So there's all these really quirky things. And I remember about 45 days into it, about 35, 40 days into it, I'm going to open one of these sodas. So we dig our fighting hole for the night. I pop open the soda, man. It's really slow. I finished my fighting hole kind of early. Some of these other guys, they were still digging theirs, but I called them over and we shared that soda. And it was the best soda I've ever had. I hung it in the sock. It evaporated. It got cool. I really took my time to just make this soda like the best it could be, because I opened it real slow to listen to the pop, to listen to the fizz, and we passed it around and we enjoyed that moment. And you know, with that, that was the only moment that I remember having before we finally finished our move through. But during this time, I mean, one other significant event was we got up to get ready to take and move into Baghdad, and it was early morning. Wake ups at 0400, because that's when the enemy right around that time would attack usually, in historical times. But we get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, but right at four, reveille that day was the sound of all our artillery launching into Baghdad. And it was the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life.
Wow.
Best fireworks show. You can't compare it. Rounds down range. It was on point. Things were getting hit. Helicopters flying right down the middle of the road, because that's the only pathway, and you got artillery coming right by them. And you got all to the right, to the left of us, the most incredible sound. It was just, and they're firing like constantly, just dome, 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 dome. That was just,
wow.
Oh my gosh.
Symphony in the desert, man.
Symphony. Yeah. They call it talking guns, and talking guns, you know, this one fires at that fires, that fires, that fires down, and so on and so on. Next one's reloading. Boom, boom, boom. It was just, and everybody's stacked on the highway. We're all stacked on the highway. We're getting ready to do our movement into Baghdad. And it was on, And, that was crazy.
Can visualize that, man. That is, I mean, I obviously it's not the same as being there, but man, the description, that must have been, yeah, unlike anything you've ever seen in your life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we travel up into Saddam City, and we're hanging out, you know, we basically take Iraq, you know, and eventually we're up there for such a long time, and we're staying awake all night, keeping, and man, I was a driver, and for an ambulance, or not an ambulance, but for we had an ambulance right in front of me, and I was a driver with all the supplies on the back. We literally got our sappy plates too, right before that whole firing thing. C-130 lands down and gives us our sappy plates. The thing about the sappy plates that we got, they're for 5.56. I mean 2.32. I'm sorry, 2.32, which is what we fire out of the M4.
Yep.
Now, the enemy uses 5.56, so yep, we didn't have 5.56 sappies, but these sappies still protected lots of lives, because maybe the round was at an angle that, you know, it still saved their lives. So we didn't even have up armored vehicles at this time. We didn't have, you know, we had canvas doors, we had training vehicles, all this other stuff that came about. So a lot of things got spun up by my third deployment, but traveling all the way up to Saddam City. They finally said, hey, about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, we got in our vehicles and we're going to drive to our staging point for the night. And literally, man, I kind of doze off and I go up and tap the vehicle in front of me with my own. Luckily, I didn't do it that hard. But I was like, oh, shoot. But they kept us up. They kept us up, and it really became hard. So it was just one of those things. And luckily, everything panned out with that.
Not too many accidents at a sleep at the wheel.
No, and so the major war had stopped. We basically posted up at a hospital that was a training hospital, and we're basically in the morgue of this place where they would wash the bodies and do all this different you know, exploratory stuff on bodies, and we all had, you know, our sleeping bags all out, and I thought it was kind of a morbid, cool, messed up thing for us to be living in, but
right,
that's how we lived. And so we did this for a while, and then we finally said, hey, okay, you know, the major war stopped, we're good to go, handing it off to the Army, Marines, let's go, we're gonna pack up. Stop loss is in effect at this point. We've got a lot of guys that are looking to get back. So the first ones to go back are all these stop loss guys. We drive all the way back down to Diwania, and we're posted up in Diwania, and that place was like crazy moon dust. And you know, you talk about silt, and silt right. is, you know, basically like talcum powder. You're walking through it. You know, everyone's getting sick. You know, a lot of crazy things are going on. So it's,
can't breathe.
Can't breathe. Now the other cool thing, I just want to put this out. Each battalion, 1-5, 2-5, 3-5, 2-4, we all had these chickens. And I remember we got these chickens in Kuwait. And the reason why we had these chickens was because they would ride on the first vehicle, and they would be in their cage, and they'd be up front. And if the chicken died, we'd have to put our gas mask on, because that obviously means there might be some issues.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Now, some of these chickens died just because they didn't make it. But 3-5's chicken, his name was Kong Pao. And I remember that seeing this bird. When I first saw these birds, man, they looked horrible. They were just like these little skinny, like dove-looking birds. They were just gnarly. But by the time I seen this 3-5 chicken, it was the size of a turkey. I mean, it was huge.
They were fattening that thing up, man.
They were feeding it, you know, MREs, or I don't know what was going on, but I was like, oh my gosh. And I think, you know, it finally died of a heart attack in Diwania. So we brought it all the way back to Diwania, and it was this giant chicken. I mean, it was huge. I mean, it was nutty.
Trying to fatten that up for a roast, man.
Yeah, it was crazy.
That's funny, man. I didn't know that. That's funny.
So, you know, you get all these stories in your life, and you collect them, and you travel with them and stuff. And I've never really told the story like this. So you're drawing out some things that are pretty interesting.
Yeah, you know? No, and you know, it's funny. Everybody's heard the combat stories, and I don't mean to belittle that, because they're really, I love them too. They're interesting. But I just find I find these little small moments, seemingly small moments, like, you know, the chicken on the front of the thing, or that, you know, revelry being, you know, your wake up call being a fireworks show like you've never seen in your life, man. And I think those kind of things seem to stick with you later on in life more, even though at the time you note them and you move on because you got a job to do. But it's funny what sticks out. It's the whole purpose of this show, actually, is to just kind of hear those stories, because civilians don't hear that, you know.
Yeah, exactly. There's another time I'm looking back now. You know, the first patient that I had to take care of, he had stepped on a flechette, which is basically a beehive round, which kind of is like these little tiny grenade balls that fall over from a artillery round.
Okay.
And blew his heel off really bad. Had some serious problems. So I'm taking care of him, and we had just gotten our sappy plates and whatnot. And I remember this really young junior corpsman taking the guy's flak jacket with him to the helicopter. And he looks back at me, he comes back, and he's like, oh man, HM2 Seabird, thanks for, man, it felt good to really try to take care of a Marine finally. And I remember in my head, I was like, man, and the sick part about combat is that you have some morbid jokes at times, and maybe not too morbid, but I remember
have to though.
Yeah, you got to put these weird thoughts in your head so that you can understand it. And I said, man, I've been waiting 10 years to play in the Super Bowl, because I've been in for 10 years at the time. And
it's what you've trained to do, though, man. That's what you've trained. You're finally there.
Yeah, and so it was just there's plenty of stories where, you know, I was taking care of some Iraqi prisoners too. I was getting ready to start an IV on this guy, and all of a sudden he came to life and he was able to drink water. And, you know, it was just
wow.
Funny. You know,
raising you're Lazarus, man, in the desert, literally, dude.
I know. I'm like, hey man, I'm ready to take care of you. Even without the IV, the guy came to life. I was like, oh sweet, yeah. Man. I guess he's just faking it and stuff. But
yeah.
Yeah. And, but
what kind of injuries were you seeing like early on? Because obviously the temp we had, you know, it wasn't like it was later, you know, in 4, 5, 6 when it kind of,
no, got... these were all gunshot wounds. These were training wounds. Sometimes, I mean, not training wounds, but injuries because, you know, it's just inherently dangerous to be out there.
Yeah. Right.
You know, like I said, that flechette, you know, stepping on a grenade that didn't blow up in the air or when it hit the ground, these these things, you know, and then mortar rounds too. We were sitting in one area, mortar round came in and hit a couple people. We were just basically staged in pretty tight area. We finally dispersed once things started getting crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, those are the kind of things. A little bit of burns. Just the gunshot wounds was the big deal, because we didn't have that many IEDs or explosions or improvised devices or some suicide bomber stuff, but not as much as my second time.
So then once you get in there the second time, third time towards when you were injured, you noticed a tempo pickup, obviously, right? And what you were treating and that.
Well, the first, you know, finally getting back to America on that first time, and I finally was just happy to be back in America. Sorry.
No, you're right.
Finally happy to be back in America. And now I can taste the freedom that I fought for on a whole different level.
Mm-hmm.
My mindset was kind of changed. You know, the loss of guys and traveling down and having a funeral and then getting right back on the road to the mission, you know, because that's what's necessary. You know, I don't think we have the opportunity or time to grieve when the mission is required.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to wrap your mind around that. And then we start having some suicides, and I'm trying to figure this whole thing out, and it becomes kind of really crazy. And then I realize that, you know, going back to combat is where I'm going to feel more comfortable. So I get asked to go with Colonel Durant as part of the Iraqi security forces, and this is a platoon size element that really is designed to help the Iraqis, direct them to take over their country.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that we kind of have formed these things, and the army wasn't able to hold it enough. They've made some strange deals with some of the locals that are not so good, and hey, we'll stay away from this area if you just stay away from us. And so there was things that needed to happen that just didn't. So the Marine Corps got called back up and said, hey, I need to send you guys back in, and you need to kind of regulate, make sure we're doing what we need to do. And that's what happened. So this is where things, you know, this was always crazy, because we were out and about doing things all the time. We fell in on some vehicles. And again, these vehicles were horrible, thrashed. They all required major work. One was always broke. We had like six vehicles and one was always down.
Right.
We get ready to do a mission. It was like mission ineffective on that vehicle.
Right.
And I was the rescue vehicle, obviously being the corpsman, and we drove around these, and the, you know, because we were just part of the Iraqi security forces, we weren't necessarily a fighting unit. We were a unit that was there to really kind of support and help guide the Iraqis to be the fighting unit.
Yeah.
But we would show up in places sometimes down and 2-5. I remember they're like, you're driving around in this vehicle? It's not even armored, man. Right. They had L doors, and L doors are like big old metal, you know, Mac kit setup doors. We started getting that stuff, and it was bolt on stuff, but they're bolting onto vehicles that really can't handle the weight. So the engines had to change. They actually, you know, went with a bigger engine on the, finally got the 1141 when I fell in on my third deployment. But until then, I was just driving around this Humvee that had like, it had the L door, but it didn't have a roof. We had sandbags on the floor, but it had the back panel, the Mac panel, and the Mac panel was, you know, it had a little hole in the back where you can put an air conditioner, and but we didn't have the air conditioner because it was not ready yet. But I remember people asking us strange questions like that, like, you drive around in these things, what the hell? Yeah, right. And we would pull. So we had the tow bar on our vehicle too, so we were like the rescue vehicle, had to do all this stuff, and you know, I became super proficient. We can hook one of these vehicles up, throw the thing on it, and be out of there in like 45 seconds. That's about how much time we would be able to just slam and go. But it got to the point where some of these Mac vehicles, they were so heavy that our vehicle would be kind of heavy too. So it was like the tail wagging the dog when we're pulling some of these things. So it really became crazy.
Are you in what area? Are you central? Are you Baghdad area?
Yeah, we're in Al-Anbar province, which is, you know, right by, it's right by the Sunni triangle.
Yep.
It's, It's right outside of Habania. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of crazy because, and which is really, really what's weird is the 3rd Iraqi army decided they were going to put their guys in Habania. Now, we drove to Habania and we looked at Habania in this area where in World War II, the British had a base there. Okay. And they really kept it nice. And there's a bunch of British cemeteries there, headstones and bunch of things. And we're looking at this area and we're like, hey, this is where we're going to put the 3rd IA. We start taking mortar rounds while we're looking at it. I mean, we're there for a period of time. We're keeping watch and everything. Everywhere we went, we'd keep watch. And so I'd always be, you know, kind of close to Colonel Durant, making sure, you know, his vehicle was like right behind mine. And we took some casualties. I think we got about 11 guys, Purple Hearts, for different things. But, you know, we were out and about all the time. And so IEDs starting to kick off. Yeah. And because we didn't have up-armored Humvees, well, even Colonel Durant got hit. And I remember he got hit with a mortar. He got hit with some shrapnel that hit his neck. And it was crazy because, you know, you would think that most injuries, it would come by you and scrape you and leave a mark that's very distinctive. Well, he had a mark on his neck from the shrapnel that basically looked like it stamped him. You know, it had some marks going one way, some marks going the other way. And it made no sense to me except for that it hit him, it glazed off of him and left, but without causing striations in one direction. It had multiple different striations in different directions. And I was like, man, that's such a weird injury. Yeah. But I remember looking at that distinctively, you know, and we'd take guys back and take care of them and this and that. We lost an interpreter one day that a mortar round came into our facility while we were out, came into our headquarters and actually hit him and took him out. You know, just a bunch of different things that we had to encounter. Firefights.
Yeah, you were getting around, man.
Yeah. We were in the largest firefight since the major war had stopped one night when what we had to do is go down to Saddam, past Saddam Mosque in Habania, and secure with the Fallujah Brigade regarding all these weapons. And we took these weapons in the middle of the night. Went into this facility and these were Iraqis that were, you know, friends, but we didn't want those weapons to fall into the wrong hands. So we took those weapons, loaded them up with some Bradleys. We did this operation with the army unit. And as we're leaving, all hell breaks loose. A couple RPGs are hidden. We're driving down the road. We're like engaging enemy left and right. I don't, you know, then you got a whole bunch of things kicking off and in a lot of different ways. And, you know, we finally make it back to Blue Diamond, and Blue Diamond's where we were headquartered at and where we were stationed at, where we operated out of. And, we'd lost an army guy in that firefight. And, you know, we're checking our weapons, doing everything we got to do, make sure we're good to go. If we have to go back out, we will, but stuff's still kicking off. You could hear it, see it going on down there. There was a lot of American units down there anyway that were supporting the area. So it was the largest firefight since the major war had stopped. And
wow.
Luckily, you know, we made it out of there, but with the loss of one army guy, that was just a bad night. Yeah. Even tactics were kind of crazy. I remember, you know, I was getting ready to fire on an enemy, and the Bradley just like literally came right across my view of my weapon, and I immediately pulled it up. And didn't understand why they kind of crossed our weapons, but it was nutty. It was a nutty. Well, night.
What's the no plan survives first contact with the enemy, right? Like, I mean, just
no plan survives. everything changes.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Or what is Mike Tyson's going? It's all good until you get punched in the face.
Yeah, yeah.
That. No, that's I would imagine that it's a jarring experience, man. Take us to the 3rd deployment, man, and kind of that if you're willing to go into that, man.
Yeah, my 3rd deployment. That's my deployment, man. They, you know, I got asked. I said, hey, you're still part of 5th Marines, but you're about ready to go. Your orders are going to change. You're going to go to Etzen Range, and I was like, I'm just going to get to Etzen Range, and then they're going to put me with a unit to go back into Iraq somehow, and I'd rather go to Iraq with people I know. And they said, well, you really can't go with 3-5. You can't go with 5th Marines. You can, but you're going to be part of this MIT team, Military Iraqi Transition Team, where you're going to be embedded with the Iraqi military. You're going to be part of a 10-man, you know, 9 Marines, one corpsman, and you're going to go in and help them take over their country. Mm-hmm. On-the-job training, everything you need to know. So we start training, and we train hard. We train for all kinds of things. Fire support missions, we train McPP, we do all kinds of different training exercises, become super proficient in all kinds of weapons, and really just training to be, and I look back to wanting to be a Navy SEAL at the time, you know, we're going to be basically an operating unit without, as an advisor group. We're not supposed to engage, we're not supposed to be that crazy, but if we have to, we have to, and we're going to be out in a lot of dangerous areas and things of that nature. And these teams started up. You got the MIT, you got the POET, which is point of entry teams, SPIT, special police operation teams. These are teams that are gearing up to be embedded so that the Iraqis can take over their country. And so we went over there and we did this. And you know, I had a really awesome team of guys that I trained with, that were my brothers left and right. We had each other's backs all the time. But a lot of times we had to do missions on ourselves with the Iraqis. So there might be two Americans with going out with a platoon of Iraqis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these guys didn't have the discipline of trigger discipline to all kinds of stuff. And I'll just say straight up, if we didn't have the society we do as going up from kindergarten on up, coordinated efforts are super important. So yeah. If you don't think kindergarten is very important to learn how to touch your toes or do jumping jacks or sit-ups or anything like that, I advise you to look at the Iraqi, any kind of film, you know, just say, hey, Iraqi exercises with Americans. Hmm. They're totally uncoordinated with every little thing. It's crazy because they didn't have the coordinated efforts throughout their life like we do in America. So when you look at some of these things, our disciplines are so easy. But to educate somebody else that maybe doesn't have that same upbringing becomes very difficult. So it was just kind of weird, but we'd have Neglin discharge. I mean, it would be scary. So we'd always walk behind them and stuff like that. Just all kinds of weird scenarios. And we'd be out again all the time, every day, pushing out to different areas, hikes, checking out different areas. And Habaniya around that whole area along the Euphrates River looked like maybe Vietnam because they had all these pastures. They had all these fields where they'd flood them with water to grow their food, to all kinds of different.
It's really fertile area.
It is.
For them.
And it was, you know, but they're, you know, they have their cow to milk. They have weird, like really cool. Their cultures is awesome. It was an awesome culture. I worked with Dr. Ahmed, who was proficient in English, and he had to be proficient in English. He learned English and medicine at the same time.
Wow.
Really good doctor. He would run these med caps, and a med cap is basically going out and in these villages, seeing all these kids and all these people with different ailments and things of that nature, ailments of a third world country type stuff that you won't even see or hear about in America.
Yep.
Because we give vaccinations. We have such a great healthcare system. You know, it was incredible. So there was a lot to it. We went out and saw a lot of different areas, saw problems that needed to be solved, whether it's their water, their roads, their whatever it might be. But there's a lot to it that we would have to help fix.
A lot of it seemed like probably a lot of nutrition deficiencies, things like diseases you relating from that, or potable water problems, or things, all the third world, all the things you would see in a third world, I would imagine, right?
Correct.
But then imagine in a war zone on top of that, you know?
Yeah, in a war zone on top of that, and you got the, you know, 10% of the Iraqis wanting to kill you and bad. They wouldn't necessarily do it at that particular time, but when they went on leave, then they'd, you know, go form up with their groups and do all these other things. So
sorry to interject real quick. That was what I wanted to ask you about real quick, because the army was made up of Sunni Shia, right? Both. And so were you with, for those that don't know, I mean, Iraq is a majority Shia country, but Saddam was a Sunni. And so, you know, you get into all that within Islam. Did that kind of, did you see that dynamic play out over there within the Iraqi army?
At times, yeah, you would see some fighting stuff, some issues. You know, if it was, I didn't see it as much as you would think, because I think the third IA was mostly Shia.
Okay.
And so they were really, really good about taking care of each other and things of that nature. But what's weird is, like, if one guy passed out because maybe he had some issues with food or he wasn't hydrated enough, other Iraqis would just kind of feel like they were passing out. Like, they would just, it would be like a mass casualty situation.
Weird.
And Dr. Ahmed would always be like, give him normal saline. And they would come back miraculously back to life. And I mean, there was weird things that I saw that, you know, it can only be explained by that. You get to see America's educational piece. You get to see America's developmental piece. All these different really cool things that push us in different directions. Because I get to see a lot of culture, because I was part of the MIT team, because we were out and about looking at how is the town developing? How is education going? Is schools up and running? The clinics were horrible. You know, their ER was like a chair with like some dressing material and some, you know, some anesthetic to wipe the, wipe the wound down with. And, you know, it wasn't even a bed to lay on and stuff. And, you know, their hygiene, their teeth, their all these different things are taking mass amount of pills, throughout the community. You know, their tea is basically like drinking, it's like, hey, here's a whole bunch of sugar with a little bit of tea added to it.
Oh, okay.
You know, and so diabetes runs really rampant over there and things like that. So
tooth decay, dental prop, like all of the above. Yeah, it's a lot of sugar and stuff. Yeah.
Right. And they just didn't have the pamphlets, the education that's necessary to really sustain some better possibilities for them. Right. And which is okay. I mean, I got to observe this. I got to report back on it and really kind of hopefully push the Iraqi administration to kind of change some of the ways that they were working during the time that obviously is still a war.
Yeah.
And so we get to a point in our AO alone, which is about a 10 mile by 10 mile section. We were taking 300 mortar rounds a month into that AO. So that's 10 a day. And, so we decide that we're going to push across the Euphrates River about 6 kilometers up. And we're going to take over some houses and we're going to build this place called Ratib, which was going to be the patrol base for the Iraqi military that we basically had a couple MIT teams in the area. My MIT team, Camp Cowboy, which was a 3-5 MIT team, and another MIT team that basically was going to run their Iraqis up to this patrol base, patrol out there to it, stay 3 days and then leave and switch it off with the other MIT teams and their, and the Iraqi army there. And, on the first day of this operation, we go and they have to disarm a IED that's packed under this street that we've never taken. We haven't done, but it was like one of the largest IEDs ever found in our AO. In the middle of the night, they're disarming it. Then we move forward and we push all the way up to these houses. We take them and, in the early morning at about 10 o'clock prior to that, thank goodness I went and, I had to use the restroom and got rid of everything out of my bowels. And around 10 o'clock that morning, I see these smoke plumes off in the background. And, you know, to let you know the scenario, there's a big wall around this house. There's the porch is about 3 feet off the deck. There's big pillars in front that, and there's a Humvee to the side. There's a lot of protection in my outlook of, hey, I'm going to step out on this porch. I'm going to take a picture of this smoke plume because I took a lot of pictures over there to hand out to different people to evaluate different things and stuff like that as well. As I'm stepping out on that porch and I put that camera up to my face and I take a picture, the interpreter walked in front of my first picture that I took. And I was like, oh, let me get another picture. As I'm ready to push the button, the mortar round had landed 10 meters in front of me, taken out my camera and hit me all over in the front of my body. Multiple pieces of shrapnel, over 100 pieces hit me, piercing me in multiple different ways. But luckily, the one that went through my abdomen, or a couple pieces that went through my abdomen, didn't cause any damage because luckily I had no solid tissue inside me, so it was good. But I turn around, that's when my mind registered that it blew up. So I couldn't understand it blowing up on my face because it had already happened, but it takes a while for your mind to register it. So I was ready to turn and go into the building when I felt like that's when I got blown up. But I had to reprogram my whole mindset on how it happened, because it obviously happened in front of me. A lot of it was ricochet, because if it was full on hit, it would have caused probably way more damage. And I don't know how the piece that hit my ankle, because I'm 3 feet off the deck, it would have had to hit the ceiling, bounce right back down, and go into my ankle with multiple different pieces of shrapnel in there. It looks like the Milky Way in there. One of my buddies described it as that, and I've kind of grown attached to that. So I take one step forward, and I realize that I can't, and I fall down to my knees. I'm now crawling my way back into the building. I make my way into the building. I crawl a little further. I roll over, and all of a sudden I start hearing, "Where's Doc Siebert? Where's Doc Siebert?" And I don't hear anything. Like, no one's like saying, "Hey, he's right here." So I imagine somebody was basically like, you know, doing the, you know, the hand across the throat, like, "Hey, he's done. He's right here." And right. I hear the guy go, "Oh shit." And, I then start looking at like, wow, shoot. Dr. Ahmed was out there with me too. And he actually got hit as well. He lost a testicle, one eye. We both make it back into the building. He made it, luckily, so did I. But I'm laying there bleeding, and I realize that I got to start treating myself, and I start stripping myself down. I'm like talking Marines through how to take care of me, and now everything's like speeding up. My training kicks in pretty cool. I'm like, hey, I need a tourniquet. But a Navy SEAL corpsman shows up, cuts the tourniquet off me, says, "Hey, man, you don't need a tourniquet." Starts an IV on me, and now it's like a movie. They're moving me out to the helicopter. Two helicopters show up, 246s, and they're now taking us to Cottom, to the shock trauma platoon there. And this is the funny part, man. This is kind of a cool part. But I remember thinking that, yeah, this could be it, you know. And I took a moment. Let's go back a sec. The first thing, it felt like my hands were blown off. Just because I got pinged in all these nerves. And I remember being super frustrated because I wanted to see my hands. And my hands came up to my face like a karate chop to each eyeball. So all I saw was a thumb and one finger. Okay. And I go, "Come on, man. Come on, brain. Turn those hands." And I can see that I got my hands, but they can barely move because they're stinging so bad. They're just like out of control. They just feel horrible. And I start to get some feeling in them. And the first thing that I want to check to make sure that I got my nuts.
Of course.
And I reached down there, and I do, because I waited to see if I had those before I made my prayer, because if I didn't have them, I would have just said, "Hey, I want to go. Take me out."
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. You know, for a man, that's just the way it is. And
it's the first thing that I've ever – it's the first thing I think of when I hear your story. It's the first thing – absolutely, man.
So that's just one of those cool aspects. And – now I'm going to tell you a story that's never probably been on the air. You know, we finally fly in there. Then they get us loaded on these Humvees. And I remember mid-flight, man, I'm looking at my IV and it's slowly coming out. And I got the other arm in an arm board, so I can't reach over and hold it in. So it's just like I'm watching it like slowly fall out, and finally falls out. And I know I need those fluids because I don't know if I'm losing fluids inside internally. So then I just cut. Then I just, once it falls out, the IV, then I shut my arm and I close the one arm so that I'm not losing any blood out of where the IV fluid's at.
Right.
But I get into these Humvees, we get loaded up, we go to the shock trauma platoon, and I remember coming in and there's all these nurses and it's hot. So they have their blouses off. And I remember this nurse like holding me up in up against her chest. And I remember thinking, this might be the last set of tits I ever have my head up against. And she's like, "Hey,
if you gotta go, that's the way to go, right?"
Yeah. And she goes, "Oh, we're gonna take care of you, you know," and there's all these nurses around. And then, you know, the last thing that you get to fill, and this is because they want to make sure you don't have a spinal injury, the doctor puts his finger up your ass to make sure that you have good sphincter tone, because if your sphincter doesn't grip, it doesn't clench down, then you might have a spinal injury. So luckily I didn't have a spinal injury, but that was the last thing I remember before I got gassed out, right? Before I got knocked out.
Doctor sticking his finger up your ass.
Now, I've told this story to a nurse before, and she's like, you know what she says to me? She says, it's all about tits and ass with you guys, man. It's all about tits. I go, literally, that's what it was about for me. That's really what happened. But I wake up and the guy taking care of me in the corner, he's like, whoa, man, I've never seen anybody wake up that happy before, because I was so happy that I made it through. And, but at this point, I have a long time in front of me. They had to cut me open, pull all my intestines out, put me back together. I hear all this story. I had my last rites read to me. Mm. I hear this story. I had no idea that had happened. But General Ayala, who was at the time, Colonel Ayala, he basically ran all the MIT teams for our AO area. And, he was there. He saw it. And then I see him later, and he stands up, gives me this big hug. He's a general at this time. And he's like, hey, man, last time I saw you, you weren't going to make it. Your tongue was hanging out. All your intestines were out, and boom, boom, boom. And I'm like, oh, I don't remember any of this, man.
That's a good thing not to remember, I guess. No, jeez. At least your last memory is your face in a chest and in a woman's chest. And
exactly. This is the kind of, humor that kind of is out there, and it's, just – it's not acceptable in our society. Some of these things are kind of raw and crazy, but this is life. This is my life. This is what happened. This is how I view it. This is how I frame it. This is how things work. And I get back and I go through all these processes, and I'm in a wheelchair, a electric wheelchair for 2 or 3 months. And I have to wear a boot on my ankle. I have to go through a lot of physical therapy. I have to have plastic surgery on my stomach because it looked like, a giant vagina. My wife would always say that to me, and I was like, so I got that all fixed up, and it looks good now. But
were you when you were flown out of Ireland, did you eventually go to Germany? Is that kind of
I went to Germany. That's the path, And I remember, being on the bird, and they had me way up high, man, and I'm a pretty big guy, so they had me all stacked up on this. C-17, the Air Force, the Air Force does a lot of really good movements, and they, for medevacs, for their treatment. But I was a little taken back at one point, because I'm in this waiting area, in Germany. Let's go back to a little bit, cause I was still in Iraq. They get us to our first location. I want to say it was, Balat or, somewhere in Iraq, but literally they're taking mortar rounds. They put a fire, they put a blanket over me, a blast blanket, because they're taking mortar rounds on the airbase at the time as I wake up from surgery. And I'm in the ward, and it's just like boom, boom, boom. So again, here we are in a mortar barrage. It was kind of crazy. But
can't catch a break, man.
A little further off in the distance. So it was, thank goodness it wasn't, But we finally get to Germany. I stay in Germany for a couple of days, and then finally start traveling back to America. One of my wounds on my chest becomes infected. I'm telling the doctor, hey, I think you need to give me a shot of penicillin or something like that. And there was one point before this, that really kind of got on my nerves, because I was waiting and waiting and waiting. And I was like, hey, man, my stomach feels like it's kind of bloating, and I'm going to fall apart. And I'm like, hey, I need you to take my vital signs or something. And the Air Force person I was talking to says, oh, we only need to take half your vital signs. And I was like, half? What half would that be? I'm like, I'm a corpsman. There's no half vital signs. You take the whole thing. So I was kind of getting frustrated. And then the nurse finally came over, and they gave me some medicine or Pepto-Bismol or something. So just because my bowels were just trying to realign themselves and cause this. But I literally felt like I was going to pull apart. Jeez. And because my stomach was obviously bloating, because there's, damage to it, and they've just done some, all the surgeries and stuff. And so,
what's your mindset like at this point? Like kind of getting back to the States initially and stuff. How are you processing this?
Oh, my mindset gets a little crazy. And this is what's interesting. I get to Walter Reed.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter Reed, my epidural came out. So they had this thing in the back of my spine that was basically connected by a tube, two screw-on pieces that screw on, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing is screwed together, and the pipe comes out from the back. Mm-hmm. So it's still screwed, but the tube came undone. So they're like, hey, we can't put this tube back on you because it might cause infection now. And so we now have to send you, and they did all this dressing changes to me and all this and that. So now we need to send you to Bethesda. So I'm like, oh man. And this is like 6 hours into the landing. So an ambulance comes, picks me up, drives me, you know, 2 hours to Bethesda. I pull into Bethesda and I swear I felt like a race car. They pulled all the dressings back off me. Oof. All these different doctors are in there looking at me. All these orders are being put in. Hey, we need this. We need that. Blah, blah, boom, boom, boom. Because we're going to put you in surgery tomorrow because we got to clean out your ankle and we got to get all, you know, some more shrapnel out of there that we can, as much as we can, and all this other stuff. But we need to x-ray your ankle. So I'm literally in the x-ray till 6 a.m. right before my surgery. So I literally finish up about a half an hour before my surgery. And I'm like, hey, man, as soon as you guys give me, I hope you guys knock me out soon because I need a nap.
Yeah, sleep. Right.
Yeah. So I wake up from that surgery and it's kind of weird because I was like, hey, you know, I'm just sitting there and I'm turning blue. And the guy's like, hey, you need to breathe. And I'm like, what? And I didn't know I wasn't breathing because the morphine had, you know, suppressed my breathing for so much that I was just like sitting there and not breathing. So literally I had to kick my brain into, hey, take a breath, blow it out, take a breath, blow it out. Mm. It didn't automatically kick in. So luckily I figured that out. So now when I wake up from surgeries, I'm very careful to immediately start breathing. So there's a lot of things that you learn about yourself, but what happened at Bethesda is I get there and I'm like, hey, I need to talk to the chaplain. And I said, hey man, I don't understand. I'm supposed to be the corpsman. I'm supposed to be the guy. I'm not supposed to be the guy that gets hit. I'm supposed to be taking care of Marines. My team is back there. I don't know what's going on with my team. And I remember my team calling me on the phone somewhere between Germany and there. And I remember Master Sergeant Lily Florin at the time is Master Guns Lily Florin, retired now. Jay, him and I did everything together. It was really cool. Did a whole bunch of logistics capability stuff and made sure the vehicles were up to par, you know, just a lot of really cool things. But he called me up. He was, I think, the first guy to talk to me. And he's like, what's up, quitter? But I remember that being like that camaraderie, yep, love.
That's right.
Fucked up kind of way to say, how are you doing?
How are you doing?
That's but right. But I loved it. I loved, yep, it. I wouldn't have changed it. I wouldn't have. There's nothing about that that just sticks out in my mind that I just love that he said that to me.
Because it makes you feel like you're back again with those guys, man. And it's, yeah. And it makes you feel.
And I'm, yeah, like, dude, I didn't quit on purpose. And so they pass the phone around and everybody talks to me, you know, and, you know, everybody's giving me my well wishes and stuff like that. But, you know, I was really kind of bummed. You know, I'm not there. I'm not. And the chaplain came down. He says, you know what? Sometimes God delivers you. And that, I think, was the first step in my healing process of trying to wrap my mind around, yeah, he delivered me, but he delivered me back to the United States. He delivered me back to my wife. He delivered me alive to bring on new challenges in your life, mm-hmm, and figure out where that goes. So here we are, you know, all the healing process. I finally am asked to go to Wounded Warrior Battalion West. Wounded Warrior Battalion West is really designed to take on our combat vets, our wounded, ill, and injured. I'm there as a patient / staff. I'm going through a lot of different things. I'm learning a lot about myself. I'm taking on new avenues of support and giving that support back to the staff and everybody else, the combat vets, the wounded, the ill. And a lot of America is pouring their minds, hearts, and souls into Wounded Warrior Battalion West to give great opportunities to this, and that. And, you know, I'm there for the rest of my career. Basically,
where is this located?
This is on Camp Pendleton, right?
Still on Pendleton. Okay.
Yep. Right next to the hospital, the old hospital. But it's very conveniently located right by the lake. Really, really a plush, really nice place for our healing to, mm-hmm, occur.
Yep.
I train in this underwater treadmill at Tri-City Wellness Center, in Carlsbad. And I send a report up to my commanding officer, which is Lieutenant Colonel Martin at the time. And he sends it up to Headquarters Marine Corps. Headquarters Marine Corps says, yeah, we're going to put this facility in the Wounded Warrior Battalion West. And the underwater treadmill is part of that primary gear.
Very
as
cool.
A training, exercise piece, because physical therapy, for me, it was physical therapy. It was awesome. It was the best piece of gear I could ever wish for. And I still utilize it today when I'm down there. Every Tuesday that I can, I utilize it. But Wounded Warrior Battalion West now has that piece of gear. And I remember the Navy saying, hey, you can't do that because it's you guys aren't physical therapists. And they're like, we're not going to call it physical therapy. We're going to call it training. So it's
that's how you skin that cat.
Yes, exactly. But if you want to come bring some physical therapists in and utilize it as such, you can do so. So that was a really cool thing that was put together that made a difference, and it makes a difference in everybody down there's lives. But I was there till 2011, and in 2011 I retired from Wounded Warrior Battalion West, and I had my Navy ceremony of retirement. I remember Lieutenant Colonel Martin, the last thing he says, permission to go ashore, permission granted. And gives me a salute, and he said, that's the first time that, and probably the only time that he'll be able to do that.
Yeah.
So it was kind of cool to see his feedback on that. And really appreciated the Old Glory ceremony and stuff, because not all the time do the Marines have the same ceremonies, but they're pretty similar and close in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really kind of an honor for me to be able to retire from there in that fashion.
Absolutely, man. Well, you earned that, dude, for sure.
Yeah.
And tell me, so like post service, just so you, when we'll go through all the links that people, how people,
yeah, there's a lot to it, man. And I know I didn't realize it was going to be, we're 1 hour and 40.
No, dude, listen, that's no problem for me at all. It's only on you. I'm just curious how you, just so everybody knows how I found Aaron was, I reached out to, there's a Warrior Built Foundation. And then I looked up, they recommended I contact Aaron. I looked him up, and Aaron's involved in 62 different things helping vets. And I just think one of the reasons I want to talk to you so much is because I love that you're still involved and you're still giving back, man. And so, like, where did, and obviously service is the best form of healing. I can imagine. You probably get so much out of that and being able to help guys out, man. So what,
there's
from your 2011 to now, kind of talk about what you've been doing, man.
Yeah. I got out, but this is how I got on. Cause Nick Ham was also there. He's the president of the Warrior Built Foundation.
Yep.
He was combat wounded as well. Went through a lot of processes himself, wanted to start the Warrior Built Foundation, which is vocational recreational support. So even before, when I got out, I realized that Nick was doing this, but Nick was very involved in a lot of other things. He would ask me to come down, fly the flag, I brought 200 motorcycles on deck.
Nice.
through the Iron Horse Foundation, Iron Horse Marine Foundation. And then there was a lot of involvement with all kinds of nonprofit organizations at Wounded Warrior Battalion West. And I saw the ones that really made a difference, ones that didn't always, ones that were really cool, some that weren't. And Nick Ham started this, and it's a really cool organization. It allows the guys to come in, learn how to work on their vehicles. It allows them to come in mainly to learn to work and get involved with the team building exercise of racing the Baja 1000, the Mint 400, Vegas to Reno, other crazy races, getting the guys involved in their lives. Now we have a lot of Warrior Built guys racing their own race. We got a couple of them actually going to Ironman this year's Vegas to Reno race.
Nice.
And that's basically the 14th of August, 14th and 15th of August, depending on this COVID. But that my involvement in that was just one aspect. I also work directly for the PTSD Foundation of America, which is peer-to-peer mentor support for our combat vets, and getting them to Camp Hope down in Texas and Houston, and giving them a new hope for life, 4 to 6 months down there. I'm a maintenance program, or a program that'll keep you away from Camp Hope, just by coming to a warrior group on a weekly basis, to a Zoom meeting warrior group, to this, and that. So there's a lot. And then I'm involved with coordinating a lot of efforts for these guys to get, maybe they need some legal support, their benefits. I don't do those. I have a lot of really cool resources that I knew while I was in that have also transitioned to, that I've met since I've been out, going to a lot of different events, helping out myself. I am addicted to the support network.
Yeah.
Now, if you're going to have an addiction, there's a lot of addictions out there, alcohol, drugs, all these things that are really going to tear you down, tear your body down, tear your life down, ruin your family. They're going to take you to a place where it's going to be your best friend, but it's not. you know, I'm addicted to the support networks out there that are making a difference. I like to be considered where the rubber hits the road, meaning, you know, you come to me and hopefully I give you a course of action that is immediately going to make a difference in your life, whether it's a conversation, whether it's, hey, why don't you come to this? Why don't you come to that? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Something of great value in that aspect of support. And my biggest thing is I can only help those that truly want to help themselves. Mm-hmm. And I can only care about you as much as you care about yourself, because I have to care about myself too. And when I'm in these groups, I'm very selfish. I take what I tell you to be selfish, because you need to be selfish when it comes to help. Mm-hmm. If you're there for the right reason, if you're there to get help, then drink that Kool-Aid and get it.
Yeah.
And I have done that, and I still do it. I'm not saying that I'm healed, and anybody that says they got a cure for PTSD is the only cure for PTSD is memory wipe, because my memories are still there. My memories are affected, whether it's traumatic or not. I can deal with it, but I don't want it to go away. I don't want my memories to go away, because they've established and they've made a direction for me to who I am. Do I want to be a better person with each one of those things? Yes. But for you to say you have a cure for PTSD, memory wipe is the only cure.
Right. Right. Well, you can't take that. I mean, it's made you who you are. And I think probably there's a lot of people coming up the pipeline that benefit from you going through that experience and then establishing yourself as kind of like a nexus for help. It sounds like what you do is just kind of, you know, act as a node for people to come to and point them in the right directions, whatever they need. You know, it's what it sounds like anyway, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I utilize so many different resources, even for myself, people that I genuinely have legit relationships with that are important, because I don't want to just bring in 50 Marines, 50 guys today. I don't want to send 50 guys to dig ditches today because some job has that opportunity. It's all about finding that sense of purpose. And it's all about building a relationship that's legit and meaningful, because that's all you got in this world is a quality. Quality of life is really what I operate on. You know, I don't know necessarily how much things cost. I don't follow business practices that well, because I operate on an economy based on quality of life. There are so many really awesome organizations and things that I'm involved with that steer some of our combat vets in some very awesome directions, and, you know, that gives them the livelihood that they might need. You know, my wife manages all my finances. I basically live on my allowance every week, which is fine.
You chose well, man. That's good.
Which is fine. You know, I totally dig myself. You know, I'm able to, you know, put fuel in my car, go out to my, you know, places that I like to eat, go to the gym now. And, you know, sometimes you don't know how depressed you are. Sometimes you don't know how upset you might be, or you don't know that you're really dealing with things that cause you to really break yourself down. And sometimes even myself, I have to take a look at and reevaluate myself all the time. And I don't always do good at that.
Yeah.
And, you know, recently I just started going back to the gym, and I started to realize that, hey man, I was really kind of slipping down a slide where depression was kind of settling in, and I was sleeping until 10 o'clock before I had to work and really start getting up and reaching out to the combat vets that I do and really trying to make a difference. And when I'm doing that, I'm fine. But, you know, outside of that, I was really just kind of like, blah, eating wrong, doing a whole bunch of stuff. And so it was really awesome for me to be able to pick that up over the last couple of weeks now and start really picking it up and getting motivated, wherever that motivation might come from,
getting you back in a positive way. Yeah. Getting you back refocused on the path. And that's, it's a reminder. You help other people, but at the end of the day, you have to help yourself as well, if you're going to be useful to everybody else, you know?
Right.
So, and I want to mention too. So, Aaron is part of the Warrior Built Foundation, and that's warriorbuilt.org. But he also has a Combat Vet Vision, and you can find. I want you to talk about that, because that's your podcast. Aaron has a great podcast that everybody should go check out. I'll put the link in the show notes for everybody to check that out. But why don't you talk a little bit about that and how people can get you there?
Yeah, that's funny, you know, because sometimes I forget that I have this, and this keeps
right.
going. Yeah, the podcast is Combat Vet Vision, and the really thing about it is to educate the public, to give them a good scope on, you know, what can we do? And I work with a lot of employers that want to make a difference for these guys, or I work with a lot of sponsors and supporters that make a difference for these guys at Warrior Built Foundation, to the PTSD Foundation, Operation Silver Star, to all kinds of different organizations that are doing incredible things. It takes a lot of different people to make a difference. And my podcast is really designed to kind of educate the public on some quirky things that maybe some guys are dealing with some other aspects of how your leadership might develop to be a better employer for somebody who's been in the military or combat. Then it's also for the combat vet himself or herself that's sitting there in their house wondering what they're going to do with their lives and how they're going to shape or what they're going to do to get help, or do they really want help? Do they need help? It really gives them some ideas, some perspectives, and maybe a little bit of framework to help them move forward in a more positive direction, whether that's measured in feet or inches or centimeters. Moving forward in a positive direction is really my goal for anybody, for myself, awesome. And for others.
And then real quick, just to reiterate, how do you want people to contact you, guys that are maybe vets or people that want to help? What's the best way to contact you?
Yeah, you can find me in all kinds of different ways. You can find me on the internet under Combat Vet Vision. Anytime you look that up, you're going to find me. Warrior Built Foundation, you're going to find me. The PTSD Foundation of America, you're going to find me. You'll be able to find me in that aspect. Okay. Other than that, you can find me at chief@warriorbuilt.org.
Yep.
Or aaron.siebert@ptsdusa.org. Or my phone number, 951-805-2734. You can text me or call me on that. I may not answer a call because if I don't recognize the number, I kind of let it go because there's a lot of different weird like sales pitches.
And robocalls and all the other crazy stuff.
But if you leave a message, I will call you back. Awesome. And I definitely will do that. But yeah, you can definitely look me up at warriorbuilt.org and look up Chief, and it'll give you a lot of information.
Man, that's awesome, dude. You're doing great work, man. So I really, really, really appreciate your time and getting into those stories, man. I know you're digging through a lot of memories. So, and I really appreciate you sharing with us, man. I really enjoyed it, man.
Well, thanks a lot, Nick. I appreciate you, man. I appreciate what you're doing here. You know, and there's a lot of other combat vets that I talk to, and a lot of things. Should you want some other guys on your show, or if you want to get me back on your show at some point, feel free to hit me up. I know. The information I did not know would take an hour and 54 to cross.
Yeah, right.
you really drew it out pretty well. I really like this aspect. I definitely will look forward to listening to this because I think I've told this story maybe the best that I've ever told it, or at least the most thorough kind of captured, even better than when I told it. On my podcast, it was my very first show. I went through a lot of different things, but I definitely think this is an awesome capture.
Well, that's cool, man. I'm honored to that, man. And that's the whole point of this, man. It's my little, I wasn't, my back gave out and it wasn't good enough to make the Marines in 2004. So I've been looking for a way to kind of, you know, maybe give back in my own little way. And hopefully this is maybe a way to help guys out to do that. And so I really appreciate you.
I would even like to feature this show on my Combat Vet Vision, if possible, just so that you get recognized too, and it just obviously you'll tell my story.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's anything and everything, all of the above. As many guys as you that want to talk, I love to do these shows, man. I really enjoy it. I always learn something, and like you said, most importantly, you get a chance to tell, you know. Work through your story, talk about it, and you know, anything to help the mental space and get guys help, you know, through you, is it's all to the good as far as I'm concerned, man.
No, it is, and substance abuse too. I mean, let's just touch base on that real quick.
Yeah.
You know, if you're dealing with substance abuse stuff, you know, there's all kinds of things that I have related that a combat vet can get involved in, and the whole thing, the process. Obviously, there's a lot of bureaucracy and help, and I talk about that static and help. But really, if you need help, you know, get it, and let's get you into a clean facility, get you sober, and then let's send you to Camp Hope, where you can get that peer-to-peer mentorship and that 4 to 6 months of reset on your life if you need that.
Yeah, yes. Awesome. I know there's a lot of guys out there that need your help, man. So that's I'm glad you're getting this message out. That's really cool, man. Well, Aaron, man, this has been awesome, man. And again, thank you for your time, man. Combat Vet Vision, Warrior Built Foundation, reach out to Aaron and make use of what he's doing, man. So cool. Well, thanks a lot, Aaron. Let's touch base again, man. I definitely want to keep in touch.
Well, thanks a lot, Nick. Hey, yep. This is Aaron Siebert, retired Navy chief, signing off. Strength and honor.